Okay, the next presentation is in two parts, but in one presentation. It's on, the first speaker is Hannah Dodd from Consumer Law Action Center, talking about using consumer law in the NDIS context. And the second speaker is Natalie Straub from the Specialist Disability Accommodation Implementation Project at the Department of Justice and Community Safety around the reform to the Specialist Disability Accommodation Tenancy Legislation. So welcome.
Okay. Good. Hi everyone, how are you going? My name's Hannah. I'm a lawyer at Consumer Action Law Centre. And today I'm just spending a short amount of time going through with you some ways that hopefully you can use the consumer law or even just be aware that the consumer law is available to assist clients that you may be helping as an NDIS participant. I'll start by saying that this is standard disclaimer for a legal service. It's not legal advice, it's information only, but we do have a worker advice line that I'll be providing the contact details for you at the end. I'll leave our little pamphlet out at the door that we really hope that you do want to contact if you have any issues that you see about what we might be speaking with today. So for my part of the presentation, what I'm hoping to go through is just flagging how the consumer law is linking with the NDIS now, then going through a few of the key issues that we've seen come up from people who are working with NDIS participants, mainly for you to see it as a flag, that if you see these things happening, you think, oh, maybe CALC can help with that. Maybe I'll give them a call, because there might be more options, I guess, in your toolkit of ways that you can help your clients. And then I can go through briefly a few ways that you can help us to assist your clients, and also ways that you yourself, if you have capacity, can help your clients with consumer law issues. I will say generally that we won't be discussing today anything about the NDIS system broadly or any eligibility for the NDIS. Our service is by no means experts in the NDIS, that's you guys. We are specialists in consumer law, and we applied for this grant because we identified when the NDIS started that meant consumer law now applied, and we wanted to be across what issues were likely going to come up for participants who are now dealing with a new service that's covered by the consumer law. Equally, we won't be discussing anything about reviewing plans under the NDIS or appealing decisions made by the NDIA. So things like that aren't covered by consumer law. There's a whole other set of legislation, which I'm sure you're much more across than me. That's something that is separate to the stuff we're speaking about today. Can I just get an idea if anyone has heard of Consumer Action Law Centre before? Yes? Great, that's good start. Has anyone called our worker advice line? No? That's okay. Hopefully by the end of today you might be interested to do that, if it's something I can help with. I guess with the NDIS, like I said, consumer law is only one small part of it, but it is a big issue that we're seeing coming up more and more, and we are trying to reach out to disability support workers and this sector generally to really come and contact us. We're a campaigns-based centre, so we're a legal centre, but we also have a big policy and campaigning team, and also we run the National Debt Helpline for Victoria, so we have a big financial counselling team. We're very strategic in the advocacy and the legal work that we take on. So we really want to know from you if there are issues that are cropping up over and over again with the NDIS, because that means that people like me can push my managers and the campaigning team to take action on it and take more cases. All right, so just briefly, the NDIS, sorry I keep turning around and then losing the microphone to check it's working. So the NDIS, when that came in, it meant that the Australian Consumer Law now applies to service agreements between NDIS participants and the service provider. The reason for that change is because previously all service provider agreements were between the government and the service provider, I'm probably telling you things you already know, but now they are an agreement between the service provider and the individual participant directly. So that enters them into the consumer marketplace, and the Australian consumer law is available to those agreements. So this is quite a significant change, and I'm wondering that maybe it's something that previously disability support workers haven't really had to worry, or the disability sector generally haven't needed to be across the consumer law, because it's a new thing that's come into your space. So just to give you a sense of the kind of issues that that we're trying to discover or be mindful of when helping clients that are NDIS participants, I've got some phrases up on the board of some common comments that might be made to people. So things like, oh, this isn't what I paid for. I was given the wrong impression about the service I was getting given. They were misleading. They pressured me into the decision. The sales were made over the phone, or they knocked on the door at my house. The contract's really unfair. The business gets more out of it than I do. Or there's debt collectors that are hassling me. So all of those sort of phrases of people, probably in your own personal life at least, if not with clients, you've probably been familiar with it, having these things happen to you. If these things are coming up, there's a good chance that there is an application of the Australian Consumer Law, and there might be rights under the Consumer Law that could help clients in those positions. I won't be going through all of them today, but I will be touching very generally on some of the key issues that, like I said, we've seen with or that have been fed back to us by people working with NDIS participants. So the first one is consumer guarantees. So the Australian Consumer Law has guarantees written into the law that when businesses sell goods or provide a service, they must guarantee that those goods or those services come with certain guarantees. So they don't have to be written into the contract, they're in the law already, and they're separate from any warranty or guarantee that's already written into the contract. Suppliers cannot contract out of these guarantees, so they can't say, don't worry, they don't apply to us. They can offer you more, but they can't take, this is the base level. So in relation to goods, the three guarantees I've put up on the slide there. So the first is that the goods will be guaranteed to be of acceptable quality. Next is that the goods will be fit for the purpose that they are being supplied for. So that could be something that you've specifically asked for. For example, if you go to buy a car, you say, I want an automatic car, I can't drive manual. And they go, don't worry, we've got just the car for you. And it comes out of the lot and it's a manual car. It's a car that works, but it's not fit for the purpose that you needed it for. The goods also need to accurately match the description. Particularly, this is relevant when you haven't had an opportunity to view the goods before purchasing them. And I'm not sure if this is something that happens when people receive products from NDIS providers. I'm getting a few nods that you maybe call up and order it and it comes in and you haven't actually viewed it first. So one example of this happening, I guess, is if someone's needing a new wheelchair and they receive the wheelchair, but it's pretty evident as soon as they get it that it's too large, can't even reach the arms over the rests, and moving around in the wheelchair causes pain. So, and when you contact the company, they say, this is nothing to do with us, we can't fix it. Has anyone had an experience like that? Yep, okay. So I'd say in this circumstance, like the example I've got there is with Sally. Sally would probably have rights to say to that service provider, regardless of anything with their NDIS package, you sold me a wheelchair that is not fit for the purpose that I need it for, and you knew what I needed it for. And so you need to either resolve this issue by making adjustments to the wheelchair at your own cost, or if that can't be done and it's a significant problem that can't be remedied, they need to either give you a refund or replace it. Equally with service providers have an obligation to ensure that when they provide a service, it's done with due care and skill. They also need to ensure again that the service is fit for purpose, and if there's been no time frame allocated for when they're going to deliver that service, that it's provided within a reasonable time frame. I will say the third one is most often used against tradies who you're trying to get work done at your house. That's the most common complaint we get about the reasonable time frame. No disrespect to tradies, but that's the one there. In relation to NDIS participants, the example that we've got there, just to give you an idea, is Mark, who needs an OT. He's got a funding package that says that they will deliver 3 hours a week. And he verbally agrees with the OT that that will be 1 hour three times a week. A few weeks later, the OT changes the decision and says, don't worry, I'm just going to come 3 hours once a week. Now, even though strictly the OT is not breaching the contract, because the contract maybe isn't written very well, or the NDIS package, he is breaching the consumer guarantee to ensure that the service provided is fit for the purpose that Mark made known to him. So there may be rights there to be able to negotiate and push back with the OT to ensure that the service is delivered in a way that's fit for Mark's purpose. Has anyone got any examples of service providers or having issues like this? Have you seen problems with... There's a few nods. Yeah. Did you want to share with us or... Yeah?
I have a particular case where a client with multiple sclerosis has been provided with some modifications to the home, and Office of Housing are funding that, and there's long delays.
Okay, great. Well, that's a very good example of reasonable timeframes, and seems to be linked to tradies, as I alluded to earlier. So yeah, so that, I guess the guarantees are often a good way of when the contract doesn't help you, or when there's nothing written down, you can't refer them to anything, you say, this is your baseline, you have to do this for me. So if you do see issues like this, please, please do contact us. The next issue that comes up that we have been hearing about from NDIS is misleading and deceptive conduct. This is one of the key issues why consumers generally contact our service. When a business has engaged in conduct that is misleading or deceptive or likely to mislead or deceive. We have heard of service providers that are using logos or colouring that is very similar to the NDIS logo or colouring, which is potentially creating a false impression for consumers about what that service is, or what it, you know, the sort of integrity of the service or what it's providing. Misleading and deceptive conduct can be done by omission. So it could be a silence. It could be allowing someone to go down a path of thinking a certain way by not correcting them when they form assumptions about the product or service that they're providing. And I think that is the one that most often comes up, where people say, well, they just sort of gave me this idea that I was going to get this service, which was whatever it is, but the contract doesn't say that. And they didn't tell me in the contract the bits that were different to what we'd spoken about. I'll say generally that misleading and deceptive conduct, because it is often done verbally, can be a bit difficult to litigate on and to go to court with. But at a level where you're trying to negotiate with a service provider, it can be quite powerful to put in writing that what your clients told you about the circumstances of the conduct. The allegation is quite significant. Okay, so the next one that we have seen coming along is high pressure sales tactics. This is generally something where a client is taken advantage of because of a vulnerability or perhaps a limitation on what they understand about the contract that they're entering. Traders being dishonest about the service or the goods that they're selling. And in some cases, high pressure sales or those kind of tactics could be considered unconscionable conduct, which is a more serious allegation and a very silly word that courts are not very good at defining. But I guess the key things to look out for with high pressure sales is if you've got vulnerable consumers who are being contacted by traders who perhaps a door knocking, which I'll get to in a moment, or contacting them by phone, pressuring them into signing up for things with the incentive of maybe getting a free iPad. We've heard that from NDIS providers, or pressuring them to sign up to a bundle package where they're saying, well, I only want this service. They say, oh, well, we only offer it with these three other services that are going to cost you more money, but that's your only option. We are really interested to know about that happening in the NDIS sector because I guess our experience as a consumer campaigning centre is that in previous circumstances where there's been government funding given or grants to organisations, for example, Vet Fee Help, a bit like NDIS, while it giving a free marketplace is a good idea in some ways, it also creates huge areas for exploitation by shonky providers who are there to make a quick buck. So we are only guessing that it's happening at the moment because we haven't had a lot of intel, but you guys are seeing it every day, so we really do want to know about it if it's something that's happening. So a little bit linked to that is unsolicited sales. So this is basically door knocking is what most people see as unsolicited sales. So unsolicited selling is anytime someone approaches you to sell as opposed to you going into the shop and asking for it. It could be by telephone and it could also be by a door knock. There is a prohibition on people coming to door knock if you have a sticker on your door like the one that I've got up there. If that's of interest to anyone, I think we could arrange to send some out. It's equally prohibited by law if you door knock someone that person says, I don't want you to continue this conversation or I want you to leave. They must immediately leave. They can't continue to pressure the sale. There is cooling off rights in the law if you do purchase something through an unsolicited sale, but the time limits are quite limited, so you do need to act quickly. If you do have a client who you see has sold something as a door knocking outcome or by phone, please do call us. We have template letters that we can help you to send out to sort of just stop the process or at least activate their cooling off rights. We have seen this a lot with companies who sell health products or very extravagant, extremely expensive beds or expensive chairs that they promise will assist people who, don't sleep well at night or have, particular back issues or various different things that just simply aren't true most of the time. And I guess the key issue with these is that because someone is invited into your home, they sit down at your couch and they wear you down for an hour, and people very easily get drawn into purchasing goods that they don't need. Do you have a question? Oh, sorry, I'll just grab the microphone for you, sorry.
Can that also apply to over-the-phone sales as well?
Yeah, yep. So unsolicited selling is included as both telephone and door knocking. One thing I will note with this is that the unsolicited sale laws will only be in effect in the first point of contact. So if they call you and say, hey, I've got this product, how about you think about it, I'll call you back tomorrow, and the sale's made in the second phone call, then it may not necessarily be, these rights may no longer apply. It's likely the consumer guarantees will still help you there because it's probably a good chance that the goods aren't fit for the purpose that you've made known. Yeah. Okay. The other one that I want to spend a bit of time on is unfair contract terms. The biggest feedback that we've received through people working in the NDIS space is the service agreements have some shonky terms in them. That are causing quite a lot of problems for people to either get out of their agreements or being forced into shifting to a different a different service provider or maybe a different location? Is that resonating with people that that's a problem? Yeah, so there are laws that protect consumers from unfair contract terms in standard form contracts. A standard form contract is a contract where the business gives it to you and says, take it or leave it. Like, we're not negotiating the terms and writing it together. Here's my contract, you can have it. So most contracts in this space are standard form and this law will apply. Some examples of an unfair term or some sort of light bulbs that might be going off as warning signs is if there's big penalties for cancelling the contract. For example, it might say something like, if you cancel, you've got to pay it all out regardless of whatever, if you've only been here for a month. Also, opportunities for the service provider to make changes to the contract that the consumer doesn't have. So they might be allowed to change the location that the service is delivered, change who's delivering the service if that's particularly relevant, use different subcontractors, which will have a significant change in how the service is delivered. So I've just got up on the slides, and I can make these available, I think, if anyone's interested. We can send them out. I can see a few people taking notes. But I've just noted the three key things to look at with an unfair contract term. So this is essentially taken from the legislation. So for it to be proved to be unfair, there needs to be causing a significant imbalance in the party's rights. It needs to be not reasonably necessary to protect the business's interests. So that really means that, like, while it's probably reasonable sometimes for a business to charge a cancellation fee or a penalty if you cancel late because that means they can't fill the appointment and they lose out, it's probably not fair that they require you to pay out the entire contract just because you miss one appointment, for example. And the third element is that relying on the term would cause the consumer detriment. Now, when deciding whether a term is unfair or not, it's relevant to look at the contract as a whole. So while the specific term, if you read it by itself, might not be seeming unfair, if it's in the tiny fine print at the bottom of page 74 of a contract that no one ever reads because who does read them, then it's probably a good indication that you've got an argument there to bolster the fact that it's unfair. So I guess just to this point, the transparency is a really big issue that comes up in gym contracts. They'll be like, whisk, 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 sale, 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 here you go, off you go, don't worry, sign that, $20 an hour, there you go. They don't point you to the bits that say, by the way, you've only signed up for a month, but it will automatically roll onto a 12-month contract once that month is over, and the cancellation fee is the whole contract. I think there are some similar providers in the NDIS space that we're having these issues with cleaning companies as well, having sort of arduous terms there. So if you do come across an unfair term in a contract, generally the legal remedy, so the outcome at law, if you can prove the term is unfair, is that the term will be stricken from the contract. It will just not apply. So the court will sort of put a line through it. If you do see them, you can try and negotiate with the provider and you could, maybe suggest to them that you think it is an unfair term for the reasons we've set out in that slide. But like I said, if that doesn't work, ultimately the next step is to go to a court or a tribunal. In most cases for this sort of work, it will be through VCAT, which I think is a bit of a barrier for most people to go to. So that's not always a very practical solution, but it is the way that it's working at the moment. If you do see terms like this, like I've said in the past, please call us. We can help you to draft letters. We can help you to give advice, or ideas for you to sort of throw into an email if you're trying to sort it out with the service provider. In some cases, we can take on the clients directly, so you can make referrals. What we've discovered through our sort of service implementation modelling and checking how is best to help the most people is that us connecting with workers is a much more productive way of us assisting clients, because you have the relationship with your client and you often have resources to be able to help scan documents or send things through. We're only in Melbourne, but we do help Victoria-wide. So we're really keen to try and engage with you, and we're happy to make multiple calls or to help ongoing where we can. So I guess just in summary, in relation to what I've covered today, if you do identify a consumer problem, please call us if you want to talk about it, because we really want to help you in this space, and we want to do what we can. Like I said, this is not our core work. So if we don't hear about it, we can't push through our policy and campaigning team to start taking action on it. But we are a very campaign and strategic organisation, so if there is a big drive for it, we can push it through as an issue that we can take up. We can help you to complain to the business or the service provider. We've got a worker at Viceline. You can just give us a call. We can chat it through. If you need to call us 5 times for the same thing, we're more than happy for that. Generally, we'll try and keep you with the same lawyer so that they've got the notes and they sort of know how it's going. A question at the back there.
Hi, just had a question around who owns an NDIS plan. So if you're with a provider and you want to change to another provider, and you have a record of your NDIS plan, I'm just wondering who actually owns that. Is that a document that the individual owns, or does that belong to the service provider?
If you're talking generally just about the contract, as in who, like, I can't speak to how it works with NDIA, whether they control the plans, but if you have a contract with a service provider, I guess it's not really, you don't really own contracts, but it's one between the both of you. You should both have a copy of it, and that should be provided at the start of the service.
They're not providing it.
They're not providing them at all.
Yeah, and that's and I because they go away after you produce an NDIS or you discuss an NDIS plan, and I put numbers in and all sorts of things.
Yeah.
To come up with what your budget would be.
Yeah.
Because I self manage.
Yeah.
But they won't give me access to all that detail.
Okay.
So
yeah.
I'm just wondering who actually owns it, so I can put some pressure on them.
Yeah, I think that it would be about putting pressure to get access to the contract that you've entered, because if they're not providing you with the terms or conditions in that contract, it's going to be very difficult for them to rely on those terms and conditions at a later date. So if they're not giving it to you, you could argue, well, it's not part of our contract. Even though I signed it, I've never seen it, so I can't be held to it. I'm wondering if that's something that potentially would be worth raising with the Quality and Safeguards Commission. Mm. I think that is, there is code of conduct that they can look at there. That, again, is not really our space, but we are quite interested to see how they deal with these issues, and I'd say that's sort of an ideal one for them.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, so the other thing that I will touch on is making complaints to regulators, for example, Consumer Affairs Victoria or the ACCC, is also quite a powerful way to get action taken on systemic shonky providers who shouldn't be in the business anymore. So the more people that can make complaints to the regulator or make it known that this particular provider is not doing what they should be, the better nous we have to get the regulators to take action. Again, we have template letters that we can help you with if you need them, or if you've got clients who are keen to advocate for themselves, that we could also help them with. And in terms of the steps that you can take with your clients or directly yourself, I guess identifying the issues that your client has is the best place to start in terms of what's gone wrong, what's the most important thing for them, because sometimes what's important for them or what they really want out of it is not what the law is going to give them. So there's no point going to VCAT or writing a big legal letter if it's not going to help the outcome that they actually want. If you do want to contact us about an issue like this, the best way we can help you is if we get evidence and documents first. So we've got an email address as well that you can send it through, and then we can set up a time to call you. So contracts, pretty much we're always going to ask for that, particularly if it's about an unfair term. Any emails or text message communications, your own file notes if you've been there from the beginning, like negotiating the contract, and also receipts and bills and things like that can be really useful for us to see. So we can help you to identify the options of what your client could do potentially with consumer law. We can help you write the letters if you need a helping hand. Sometimes just because it's not your core work, you're like, can someone look at it? I don't know if it's right. Like, and we want to do that for you. That's exactly what we want to be helping, because we want to help you do what you can. I am fully aware that most people have very limited capacity, as most of us do in community sector. And we can also talk to your client together with you if you think that that's valuable. So we can set up appointments to have the three of us speaking together. So I've just got a slide up there about our contact details. So we've got a worker advice line. Like I said, it's open Monday to Friday, 10 till 5, but closed for an hour at lunchtime. We've got a worker portal, or a sort of resources toolkit, and I will leave this form at the front door. It's just an issue spotting sheet, basically, about money troubles that might come up with NDIS or people who are helping people with a disability. It's got our contact details on the bottom for the advice line and the email address if you want to contact us. We do also have an advice line for consumers directly. If you've got a client who wants to speak to us directly, that is available. I will say our public advice line is very difficult to get through to sometimes, because we do have limited resources, like all of us do. It's only open from 10 till 1, but we also have a Koori helpline that's open all day, 10 till 5. So I would say if you are helping a client, the best way to get access to us is through you. So if you can call us to get the idea, and then we can assess whether it's something we could help the client ongoing with. So I think that's all I have time for today. If there's any questions.
A very simple question. What's the cost of your service?
Oh, we're a free service. That's a great question.
Oh, sorry, I was going to say, what's the cost of your service?
Yeah, sorry, we're a free legal service, yeah. And we've also got free financial counselling as well. Yeah, fantastic. So I'll pass over to Natalie then.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for having me today. My name is Natalie Storb. I'm the project manager for the Specialist Disability Accommodation, and I'll use SDA from now on, implementation project. A little bit about us. I'm not sure if you've had much to do with Consumer Affairs Victoria. We're basically Victoria's consumer regulator. Some of the work we do, we provide advice to tenants, landlords, property owners, consumers on their rights under our relevant acts, and we also enforce consumer law in Victoria. So today I'm talking to you about the changes to SDA tenancy law. So on the 1st of July this year, changes were made to the Residential Tenancies Act, which introduced a section which covers now specialist disability accommodation. This new section, as it's set out, is part 12A, if you ever need to dig into the legislation. And it does a few things. So probably most significantly is it creates a new type of agreement called an SDA residency agreement. And what that is, it's been designed specifically for SDA residents. It brings across many of the protections that formerly existed under the Disability Act for residential statements, and it brings it into the Residential Tenancies Act. So while it continues some of the protections from the Disability Act, it also increases some of the protections available to SDA residents, and it brings it into line with the rights available to other tenants in Victoria. So limiting a landlord's right to enter a property, being able to seek the help of the Director of Consumer Affairs for non-urgent repairs, and also go to VCAT if they have issues with their tenancy. So under the Residential Tenancies Act, there is the SDA residency agreement, but what will also be available to SDA residents potentially is a regular tenancy agreement. So that's a standard lease that people will enter into when they enter into a rental agreement. So there are some limitations around that, but there are two types of agreements that are potentially available. So the purpose for that was to give, to allow the choice and control for a person, which is in line with the policy of the NDIA. So what that does enable is for an SDA resident to live with family or friends. We've had a case of a mother who has MS, and she wants to live with her child, and they can now enter into a tenancy agreement. Also a case of a couple who want to live together. He's got a physical disability, and so now they can enter into a tenancy agreement as a couple and stay together. One of the additional features that's been introduced to the Residential Tenancies Act is protections for an SDA resident who enters into a tenancy agreement, so the regular kind of lease, against coercive or deceptive conduct. So it's really important to note, and this will be important for the kind of advocacy sector, is that someone entering into a tenancy agreement has a reduced level of protection as compared to an SDA residency agreement. So it's really important to note they cannot be forced or coerced to enter into a tenancy agreement. We can talk about that a little bit more in a minute. So just a little bit about the role of advocates under the Act. The Residential Tenancies Act explicitly recognises support people in the Act. Some of the, and this will be kind of, you'll be recognised as kind of a chosen person is the language. So some of the explicit roles in the Act for support people are to help the resident understand the agreement that they're entering into with the SDA provider, to help the resident understand any forms or notices that they're given by the SDA provider, to help the resident apply for urgent or non-urgent repairs, and there's other general support. So it doesn't limit the support you can provide, but it's explicitly built into the Act. I'm going to talk about the two types of agreements in a bit more detail and note some of the key differences, and I'll talk about kind of your role during that. So I thought it was important to highlight some of the differences between the two types of agreements that will be available to SDA residents under our Act. So up here I've got the SDA residency agreement and the tenancy agreement. The SDA residency agreement is only available to SDA residents, that is NDIS participants with SDA funding. It's also available though to Commonwealth Continuity of Support clients. So they're the two people who qualify for an SDA residency agreement. A tenancy agreement is open to all Victorians, so it's just a regular tenancy agreement. There are really important distinctions in starting an agreement between the two agreements. For an SDA residency agreement, there's the process of entering into, which means both the SDA provider and the resident will sign the agreement, or you can establish the agreement, which is consistent with NDIS policy, where the resident doesn't have to sign the agreement in order for it to be valid. And there's some steps the SDA provider needs to take to establish the agreement, but only the SDA provider needs to sign it at the end, and this is because the person may not be cognitively able to enter into a contract. So that's the reason for that. With a tenancy agreement, the provider and the resident has to be able to sign the contract. So there is a test, it's not built into the legislation, about a resident needs to have the capacity to enter into a contract in order to become a tenant under a regular tenancy agreement. And this is really important, and we realise that this is going to be an area that may get tested, and we've been, you know, talking with Tenants Union of Victoria, but I just wanted to highlight that as an important distinction today. Also, to some of the things we're kind of hearing as the SDA providers are starting to try and understand these new types of agreements. The SDA residency agreement is an agreement between the provider and each resident in a property, so they're individual agreements. A tenancy agreement is one agreement for the whole property, so all the tenants need to be able to sign it. There are some provisions for subletting, but they're really important distinctions and maybe something to look out for if you do have a client who has a tenancy agreement, and just to look at how that may have been set up. So this is kind of something we're hearing, that maybe there is a little bit of confusion about how these agreements might work in practice. Another important distinction between the two agreements is damages. So under an SDA residency agreement, a resident does not pay for damage caused by their disability, their behaviour related to their disability, or any equipment needed for their day-to-day living. In a general residency agreement, the tenants are responsible to pay for any damages. So that's a really important protection built into the SDA residency agreement that doesn't extend to a tenancy agreement. Yes, down the back.
I have a question about people with intellectual disability, mm-hmm. if they're unable to sign a residential tenancy agreement,
yep.
but they're not granted SDA in their NDIS plan,
right?
What happens? Is there anything in between? What does the law say?
I can't speak to that. I suppose it depends on what kind of agreement they're living under. Currently, I would recommend for those kind of questions on a case-by-case basis that you do give Consumer Affairs Victoria a call. Like I said, it's not written into kind of the Act about there's no test of capacity, but a contract needs to be between two people who can understand and enter into it. So please give us a call in those cases just so we can explore that further, if that's okay. So I'll move on to notices to vacate. And this is an SDA provider asking a resident to leave. Under a SDA residency agreement, a resident needs to be given a notice of temporary relocation before giving a notice to vacate. And that's for a minimum period of 90 days. So you can't ask someone to leave without first finding them suitable temporary accommodation. There are also notification requirements that an SDA provider needs to notify the NDIA, the Office of the Public Advocate, the Director of Consumer Affairs, and the resident SIL provider, I believe, when they're given a notice of temporary relocation, and they have to notify those people within 24 hours. The purpose being is that it then triggers kind of a support around that person to make sure that the accommodation is suitable and they're given appropriate accommodation. Under a residential tenancy agreement, there are laws around giving a notice to vacate, but it's more around the minimum notice period, so those protections aren't in place. With regards to ending an agreement, and this is looking at the SDA resident, under an SDA residency agreement, an SDA resident can end the agreement at any time by giving a notice of intention to vacate to the provider. Under a regular tenancy agreement, there are time periods associated with it, and there might also be lease break costs as well. So they're just a few of the kind of key distinctions. And just to say, everything I'm talking to you today is available on our website, and there is a section for support people as well, where the information has been a bit tailored to that group. So please do go online and there'll be more information about these agreements. I thought it'd be worthwhile. So what's happening at the moment, the legislation came into effect on the 1st of July, and SDA providers have until the 1st of January 2020 to enter into an SDA residency agreement or a regular tenancy agreement with their existing residents. The purpose being that after the 1st of January 2020, the protections available under the Disability Act residential statements will no longer exist and will become void. So if they haven't entered into a new agreement, the resident won't have the protection of the Residential Tenancies Act or the Disability Act. They'll become a tenant at will. So there are some safeguards in place, but that's the reality of what will happen around that time. And we're working with the department, the NDIS Quality and Safeguards Commission and the NDIA around making sure there are protections in place for residents around the 1st of January. So the process that's happening, and this is a process for entering into or establishing an agreement. So the first step is the SDA provider gives an SDA residency agreement or a residential tenancy agreement to the SDA resident. And ultimately, the SDA provider can decide which type of agreement that they will offer in their SDA dwelling. We have been attending some sessions with SDA providers to set this out, kind of noting that the type of agreement they choose will then determine the type of residence that they can welcome into their property if someone was to leave. So they choose a type of agreement that they want to offer. We know that DHHS will be only offering SDA residency agreements in their property, notwithstanding that there are some TAC clients, for example, who don't fit under the SDA resident definition, and they're looking at that on a case-by-case basis. So step two is the SDA provider gives the resident the agreement, and there's also an information statement for the SDA residency agreement and the tenancy agreement. So they have to give both things to the SDA resident. They also have to explain the agreement and the information statement to the SDA resident. If they believe that that resident would benefit from support in understanding it, they are also required under the legislation to give a copy of the agreement and the information statement and explain those documents to a support person, or a chosen person, which could be really anyone chosen by the SDA resident. So family, carer, advocates, for example, are listed out. So it's built into the legislation that the SDA provider must seek support for that client if they need help in understanding it. If the resident doesn't have a chosen person, then the SDA provider must find them someone, and that person can't be employed by or associated with the SDA provider. It's also, I wanted to note too, that the SDA agreements and information statements are prescribed products, which means that they've been prepared under regulation and approved by the Director of Consumer Affairs. The SDA residency agreement can't be changed. So an SDA provider can't make amendments to the agreement. It's as is. There is a space in the document for additional terms, which is something that's probably really important to look out for. Everything in the SDA residency agreement aligns with the NDIS terms of business and protects the rights of the SDA resident. If there are additional terms, it links back to what Hannah was saying about unfair contract terms. They have to make sure they comply with Australian consumer law and they don't take away any of the existing rights within the residency agreement or within the residential tenancy agreement. So if you are seeing additional terms, I would recommend kind of keeping an eye out for them. And if you've got any concerns, please call us at Consumer Affairs Victoria so we can help answer any of your questions around that. Also, if you're noticing there are some changes to the agreements, please also give us a call. We're really interested because this is a new piece of legislation. Please do let us know. We're interested in understanding how this is actually being rolled out in practice. So the agreement's been explained to the resident and any support person. The resident has to have a minimum of 7 days to consider the agreement. The next step is the SDA provider and the SDA resident. If the SDA resident agrees to the agreement, they enter into where they both sign the document or establish the SDA residency agreement. So the establishing is only for the SDA residency agreement. If it's a tenancy, they both need to sign. The SDA provider then gives a copy of the agreement to the SDA resident and keeps a copy for themselves. If they've entered into an SDA residency agreement, the SDA provider must notify Consumer Affairs Victoria within 14 days, and we maintain a register of SDA residency agreements. And that is, that register is available to the Office of the Public Advocate for their community visitors program. So another thing to kind of point out is community visitors have rights of entry like they do now for people, for properties where they've entered into SDA residency agreements. If it's a tenancy agreement, they don't have the same rights of entry. They can be invited to come and visit the property, but they just can't go out and visit as they have normally done. So that's how the Office of the Public Advocate will be made aware of who is living in under an SDA residency agreement in an SDA dwelling. So I know I've flown through what is quite a significant change, but I would really encourage you, if you we do have a lot of resources available, firstly, if you've got any questions or concerns, you want to understand the Act further, you've got a client who's entering into agreement and you've got some questions, please do contact us on our SDA inquiries line. We've got staff who've been trained in this legislation in the and on the NDIA too, and they will be your best first point of call for answering general questions on these new agreements and on the Residential Tenancies Act. So please start there. It's Monday to Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Please also call them too, like even during the agreement, if there's any concerns about notices that have been given, urgent and non-urgent repairs, any, you know, the inquiries line can answer all those types of questions. As I said earlier, our website, Consumer Affairs Victoria, has information for residents, providers, and specifically for support people, which goes through in detail all these new requirements under the Residential Tenancies Act. So if you haven't already, please go and have a look. You can download a copy of the residency agreement and information statements. The information statement is quite a comprehensive document, and which will help you understand the different types of agreements and the rights and responsibilities for providers and residents. I want to also note that we have produced easy English versions of both a tenancy and an SDA residency agreement and the information statements. They're available on our website. We'll be producing easy English versions for all the forms and notices that are related to SDA. We're also developing a visual aid for SDA residency agreements to help SDA providers or support people guide SDA residents through the transition to new agreements or entering into new agreements down the track. So that's all I had covered in my presentation. I know it was very quick, so if there are any questions. Okay, thanks very much.